You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Jennifer Lopez. Jennifer Lopez.
Jennifer.
Jennifer.
Jennifer Lopez.
Jennifer Lopez. No, that's,
Jennifer
I can't do
low,
it.
Low.
Jennifer.
Change your low. Vowel so it's more like low.
Low.
So
low.
Lopez.
Low. Lopez. Lopez.
Lopez?
Jennifer Lopez.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many diphthongs. Too many.
This is what the whole
this
hour
is really
gonna be.
Great.
This is what the good. Hour is going to be.
Welcome to Australian Accents with Ricky Rojas. I'm Joe Carroll and Dan with me.
Well, welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Yeah, welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals. Welcome
Ricky,
to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Welcome to Guys... I can't. I'm not even going to do it.
Welcome to Guys Who Likes Musicals. Likes?
Yes.
So an actor is saying his lines, and then out of nowhere, he just starts singing.
5, 6, 7, 8. Jimmy, don't cry for me.
Ricky, thank you for being here. We're so thrilled to have Moulin Rouge's own Ricky Rojas here. I think we're going to get into all of your credits and stuff, and which they're extensive, but I think that people will most likely know you as the mustache twirling Argentinian in Moulin Rouge, and the mustache is gone. I mean, the people can't see you, but the mustache is gone right now.
Shh, don't tell them. It's still there.
Well, I don't think that Alex Timbers and Bill Damaschke, I don't think they listen to Guys Like Musicals. I'm not sure. I don't
they
know,
might.
But like they might. They might. But the mustache is gone. Did you shave it because you were sick of it? Is it high maintenance? What's the...
Right. Let me tell you the story about the mustache. So my wife doesn't like the mustache. So that's why it
classic.
Went. Classic. Simple story. And it went. But it took a while for me to let go of it. So I got back home where I am at the moment. And, you know, it stayed with me for a couple of weeks. I was like... just can't let it go. I couldn't.
Yeah.
And then I just had to get rid of it. It went.
Yeah. And then how long does it take you to grow it back?
I'd say a solid 2 months.
Two months. Okay.
Nice and
juicy and waxy. Do you have to use like mustache?
This Dick Dastardly from what was that? Catch the pigeon, catch the pigeon, catch. Do you ever watch that cartoon? I mean, it's a really old cartoon. I'm showing my age. There was this character in it called Dick Dastardly, and he had this mustache that was like so long. And like, yeah, mustache with mustache wax.
Yeah. We'll get it back. You should take it when you leave Moulin Rouge. You should keep it for a second and try to go in for those characters, for like the evil mustache.
Well, that would have been a plan. Had COVID not happened, you know, but then I was like, what am I keeping it for?
Yeah.
I'm just working just
give it
the
a
house.
Second.
So,
we find you you were just telling me before we jumped on that you're working on your house. You live in France.
Yeah.
You're doing your full home renovation. You have a farm and a tractor and trees and land.
Do you need any help? Perhaps.
Yeah, man, come over.
Can I get on a plane?
Take, the more the merrier. I can always find you something to do. Trust me. There's so much work to do.
I have a question. What's that commute like? What's your time to Midtown from France?
If you catch the express.
I don't like to time myself, but usually I just call Uber. And he sorts it out.
Yeah, yeah. You know? right.
And I'm there like in a jiffy, you know, like super fast.
Oh, my God.
When did you move to France?
Actually, after we did with the lovely Joe Carroll, we were in the Boston pre-Broadway run of Moulin Rouge. I got home after that and I was like, I'm onto a good gig here. You know, let's strike while the iron's hot. My wife wasn't happy at work. My wife, Natalie, she worked at a bank in England for many years as a learning consultant. And she, you know, she was got tired of the rat race.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, I'm not happy. I was like, cool. She was like, what can we do? She's like, let's move to France. I was like, okay, let's do it. It was literally that easy. I kind of just went, okay, let's go. Let's bring it. Bring it on. So we put the house on the market, and we wanted to be out before the first Brexit date, which was March 19th or something in 2019. So this was like October. We put the house on the market, and we were out of England by March the following year.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, everything in storage, a couple of suitcases in the back of the car, and we drove around the south of France looking for somewhere to settle. And then we found somewhere, bought a French car, rented somewhere, put Raf in school, and then I went to start rehearsals in New York for Moulin Rouge.
Oh my gosh. Do you guys speak French?
Oui, je parle maintenant, je parle un peu de français. Mon accent est très terrible. My accent's really rubbish because I speak Spanish, but I kind of make it up. It's getting better. It's getting better.
I mean, it's immersion. You're like, fully like, so when you go to the market and stuff, and you're like talking to people in the town that you live in, do you try to speak to them in French, or do you?
Oh, yeah. You have to, because over here it's like, you do. I mean, there's not that many Anglophones here.
Right. Yeah.
There are like a few families and stuff like that. But mostly it's French. It's France, rural France, where it's a big wine region. Chinon is where I'm at.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Wow.
So yeah, market.
Yeah. It'd be like trying to go to Ohio and being like, you know, trying to get them to speak some foreign language. They'd be like, what? No.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I'm not doing that.
We're not going to try to speak French. Right. We speak English.
Yeah. They're like, they kind of just look at you like it's a lot of hand gestures and you trying to speak with the right accent. And then they're like, what? And then you speak slowly and they're like, oh, right.
And Raf is your son. Is the school like at all in English, or is it totally French immersion?
All French.
Wow.
Full on French.
That's
so
great.
It was rough. It was bumpy for the first year, especially with COVID, because he wasn't getting the social interaction at school.
Right, right.
That he would have normally got. But now he's like fluent.
Oh my gosh.
Like, damn you. He's like really, really good.
And
he's
do
like,
you speak Spanish with him too?
Like, yeah. And now he understands more of the Spanish, because he couldn't speak Spanish before, but he understands more of it because he speaks French. Mm. So yeah, we'll be a household that speaks three languages.
That's amazing.
That's so cool. That's so,
you know, it
cool.
would be, I think America would be a better place if more people had that experience of not knowing the language in order to survive, you know, like being in that situation where you have to kind of figure it out. So many people come here and that's how they feel. And we don't have any empathy for that because we have no experience with it.
Of course. Yeah. As soon as you travel, I think this is how I would fix it. This is how I would fix everything. Right. Right. I would, number one, I'd legalize weed, right? If I was the president of the America, right? Legalize weed, I'd tax it, right? Then you'd use that tax, and then I would buy a return international airfare ticket for every child or every person in America up until they're 25, right? They get one return international ticket, and they have to use it. Otherwise it goes, right? That would change everything. Because people would see that the world is small.
Right? Yeah, well, they do with birthright, you know, like in Israel. You know, people can go, it's paid for. And
Is that for real?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly who it applies to, but it's like most...
It's like any
some
I
number
think it's,
of
yeah.
Jewish young people have a free round trip ticket and a free like trip to Israel, to the homeland.
See?
Yeah.
It would change. It would change everything. Like, imagine someone from, like, I don't know, somewhere that wouldn't normally travel, right?
Yeah, we could pick on rural Ohio if we're talking about, I mean, I'm from Ohio.
Exactly. Rural Pennsylvania.
So let's pick on, like, someone from there that wouldn't necessarily have the opportunity to go, but suddenly they, even just going to the airport or leaving, traveling, the whole experience, it's like it makes everything so much smaller, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. I'm done.
You guys are so cool. That's just like such a cool thing to do. You're just like, we're going to France. I'm unhappy at my job. Fuck it. We're moving to France. Like, yeah, man. I wouldn't do that. I would.
Right. Right. This is very fascinating to me. What is that conversation like in your own head as an artist? Were you like, okay, I'm going to give up everything? Or how are you making that work? Like,
no,
I'm so, I feel so tethered to the city.
Yeah. Well, I was like, obviously I, you know, lived for many years in London and that's where my work base was. But in, for the last couple of years, I was doing a lot of touring and I was like, you know what? I could still tour and live in France. It's not that far from the UK. Like it's literally an hour flight and it costs, you know, 12 euros a flight,
right,
which is
right.
nothing to get to Stansted. So I was like, it's so doable. People do it all the time. So we were like, why not? Why not? And at that point, you know, we were like, I mean, we'd thought of moving to France like many years ago when Raph was like three. So it was always there. But, you know, it just came at a good time. So we thought, let's just do it. If we don't do it now, we won't do it because the Raph will be too old to
to start over.
Language. Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's in around sort of the Moulin Rouge idea, like you said, that like, you know, strike while the iron's hot. Like you had the show, you knew the show was going to be fairly, I mean, we talked about this back in Boston or right before I came to Broadway, that you were like, you were set for a year. You were going to like do it for a year or a little more and then maybe go back home. But you knew that that was going to happen. And I just, I wonder like, how has that plan changed at all? I mean, everything's changed for everybody.
I mean, I think it's pushed the plan, my original, I mean, like my original plan, like Moulin Rouge plan, Ricky number one, dot point. I would have finished up the show in New York last September. I would have come back here and then gone to do it in London. That's what I would have loved to have done.
Mm-hmm.
But now the timing doesn't work. Everything's like up in the air. It's like, well, you know, so
I'm
heading back to New York and then that's the plan at the moment. And then, you know, we'll see what happens.
And then who knows?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, I want to get into, we'll do a deep dive on Moulin Rouge because I want to talk all about it. But I want to rattle off some of these credits because I want, and I also want to talk about these because you did the Buddy Holly story. And that was that your West End debut?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So Buddy Holly, Burn the Floor, Moulin Rouge at the Colonial in Boston that we did together, Sister Act, Tonight's the Night, Rod Stewart, Grease, Burn the Floor again. You did two different iterations of Burn the Floor?
Yeah, I did it in New York and I did it in the West End as well.
Yeah, because Burn the Floor was your Broadway debut, right?
Yeah, that was. Yeah. It's so funny because Moulin Rouge and Burn the Floor, both 10 years apart, had exactly the same opening date on Broadway.
Wow.
Isn't that nuts? Because it was the first show of the season to open. Both of them.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah. Now, what the Buddy Holly story, that was like, you are, if anybody has ever seen you on Instagram, I mean, and we spent a lot of time, I wish more time, we would have spent more time doing this, but you're a huge guitar nut. You're a great guitar player. What was that? So the Buddy Holly story, I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like, this, you know, the story of his music and stuff. But what was that like to bring the guitar to your West End debut? I mean, this must have been something that you've done for a long, long time and sort of incorporating music.
It was, you know, it was my first show and I did it in Australia first. And then from there, went to do it in the West End. You know, it was, although I played a bit of guitar, you know, growing up and stuff, I didn't really start playing until I did that show because I was surrounded by so many great musicians. It was an active musician show. So, you know, I was learning how to play the guitar, a little bit of bass, some banjo, like it was nuts. And everyone was super, super talented. So it was, what's the word? It was a dream. It was the dream gig for a kid. And I, of course, I got to learn about rock and roll the influence that it had on all music and how it progressed. And from the Crickets, Buddy Holly and the Crickets, came the Beatles. That's why they called themselves the Beatles, because of the Crickets. It was, you know, things like that. It was very eye-opening.
what kind of music did you love growing up? Were you a rock and roller growing up, or were you more of a musical soundtracks, musical theater?
I was more into R&B growing up. I didn't get into musical theater till quite late on, till I was about, I don't know, 18, but I liked R&B, and salsas and Hispanic music as well growing up. I used to dance in a Chilean folk group, but you didn't know that.
Wait.
Yeah. Dude, I've got the hat and everything.
Wait, that makes a lot of sense then.
Yeah.
It does. Like, as far as, like, you, and we can jump into Moulin Rouge because I know that's what, give the people what they want. You were always able to hang with Robin Herder. And I think that one of the things that people, it would be very intimidating for me, would be walking into a room and seeing Robin Herder and then being like, okay, I got to dance next to, the Cassie in A Chorus Line, she's about as Broadway as it gets. So with that dancing, the Spanish influence and the tango and all the Roxanne stuff, and like, that's been in your bones.
Yeah.
It sounds like.
Yeah, like from early on, like growing up, we always danced with women, in the Chilean culture, always. And the folk group really helped that because, it taught you how to look at a woman when you dance with her. I remember we did this dance festival, and they singled that out of our group as opposed to everyone else. It's the way that the men used to look at the women. It was a very distinct way. It's almost like it wasn't, it's not aggressive, but it's like a flower, very like you just appreciate all of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sultry in a sense. Yeah.
But also that you're taking in all of it. You're taking in all of your partner. And that's so funny that you say that, because I see that, watching your performance, watching you dance that way, that is, the look is like, oh my God, Ricky, look at me that way,
Easy, easy, easy.
Look at Dan, I haven't seen him in a long time. Okay.
Listen, Joe's the only male energy Joe's had for a long time is me. So he's looking for a little change of pace.
Talk to a Chilean folk dancer.
Yeah, geez. And so did you grow up in Chile?
No, I was born in Chile. So the first 5 years of my life, yeah. And then I had my sixth birthday in Sydney, Australia.
Wow, what brought you guys there?
My dad was just wanting something different. I think, they weren't happy. Kind of like how me and that kind of we're not happy. Let's just move to France. Let's do it. So, they picked up and moved to Australia with three kids. But my family's got quite a weird history. So, my parents got married in 1969. Then they immigrated to Australia because my dad used to work for airlines, and he worked for Qantas when he got to Australia. And then my brother and sister were born in Sydney in 1970 and 71, and then they flew back to Chile in 77, I think it was. I'm not sure if it was politically related or anything because of the Pinochet or the Allende government or anything like that. But I'm not sure, but I know that my mum missed home, so they went home. And then in 1985, I was born in Chile in 1979, and then we moved back over to Australia in 85.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. And then what was Australia's known for such great theater and theater training. I mean, there's so many great places to train and great theater in Sydney and in Melbourne and all over. How did that start for you? What was the beginning of your exposure to training and all that stuff?
Yeah. I always feel like a bit of a fraud because I didn't do that much training. My sister was a singer as well, because I've got a very musical family. My sister was a singer, but she was more into She went in more into songwriting and, you know, with a publishing house and stuff like that. But she used to sing in, I don't know if you've got an equivalent to this in the States, but like in Australia, we have these places called RSL clubs, which are Returned Servicemen's Leagues clubs, like for old veterans and things.
Like kind of like the SO idea, Joe.
Yeah.
It's less popular nowadays, but we do have something that was similar to that.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah. VFW
like,
halls.
They're kind of like mini casinos, I'd say. Like you could, they've got like little restaurants and they've got like an auditorium with a band and they've got like poker machines and stuff. And, you know, it's quite cool. And lots of towns in Sydney and Melbourne all over Australia have these. And they've also got like football clubs, like rugby leagues clubs, you know, which are this kind of similar vibe. So my sister used to do shows in those clubs with, you know, she'd take her music along and do like a half an hour spot, sing five songs and give her music to the musos and talk through all her music and do her floor show. And then that would be it. And then we would do talent quests, which is kind of similar vibe. You know, you rock up, do three songs, get an appearance fee, and then you might win or whatever. It's a whole big circuit. So I used to do that, right? So little like me doing my floor show, like a Vegas kind of.
What
vibe,
was
right?
in the act? Do you remember like what were some of your songs that were in that act?
Well, I used to lean a lot into like Spanish songs. So you would sing like La Bamba, right? Which is funny because I ended up doing the musical. I played Richard Valens in the Buddy Holly story. And, you know, I sang a lot of Lionel Richie stuff. I loved Lionel Richie. And then from there, an agent saw me and put me in a Latin show, which is just specifically Latin. And I used to do shows with like a Brazilian dance company in Sydney, which was really cool. And then, you know, all this time, this is what I used to do. Like instead of working at McDonald's or Pizza Hut, this is how I used to make my money when I was at school. And then I was doing drama at school and I thought, oh man, I want to, like, I know I can sing a song, right? But I can't act. Like I knew I could, like I could act, but not really.
Right.
So I thought, what can I do? Right. So I, you know, it was just when the internet was first starting, you know, I Googled and not Google because ridiculous Google wasn't even.
Alta Vista. Like
Yahoo. Or you know, when the screen used to load so slow, it would be like.
Anyway, I remember Ask Jeeves was the coolest thing ever. I remember being like, my dad was like, we got Ask Jeeves. And you open the thing. There's a little guy on the corner. Yeah, like you ask him a question.
Little butler.
Right. How big is the world? You know, little Joe at the computer.
Anyway, I asked Jeeved and I found the ATYP, which was the Australian Theatre for Young People. And it's kind of like a subsidiary of the Sydney Theatre Company. It was in the same building, just near the Harbour Bridge in Sydney. So I looked and they had musical theatre courses and I was like, all right, cool. So I signed myself up for it. I paid with the money that I'd made from all the shows and stuff that I'd been doing like on the weekends. And I went and I loved it. I got the bug and they did a production. I got the lead role in that production. And I got an agent from that. And you know, who was in my course was Rebel Wilson, which is
really cool. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she's done all right. She's done all
yeah,
right.
Yeah, she's okay.
But she was I think at the time she was studying law at university.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's what, did you ever, so was there ever a feeling of doing something else? Did you ever like, as you're like moving through your young life, it was like all music, all performing, or was there any tinge of like I should have been a farmer or something?
Not really, you know.
I
not
love it.
Really, the only thing, you know, I liked filmmaking, so I went to university and I did a couple of years of media production, but besides that I was like, I don't know anything else.
This is it, you know. This is it. We're talking a little bit about the Moulin Rouge stuff earlier, but can we talk? I want to go through your audition story because this was very cool. Just knowing, like, they had an unbelievably difficult time finding anyone to play Santiago, to be the Argentinian.
Yeah.
And I remember your story just being like one of these kind of West End dreams in a way. Can you tell, what was the story? Can you tell us your audition story?
Yeah, right. So I was at home one day and I get an email through from my agent, who's also happens to be my best friend. And he's like, dude, you know, Moulin Rouge is auditioning, sending you up for an audition. I'm like, oh, cool. I've always wanted to be on that, in that show, if it was ever a musical, you know. I'd love to play the Argentinian. I think I'd, you know, be great.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked and I was like, yeah, cool. I'll go to the audition. Great. And then I kept reading and it was like, it's opening in Boston. I was like, damn, I thought it was opening in London. Right. And I was like, do I go? Do I not? Do I bother? I was like, nah. I was like, babe, I've got an audition for Moulin Rouge. Should I go? Should I bother? She's like, yeah, well, just go. You're probably not even going to get it. Just go. You haven't seen the cast director in ages.
Classic.
I was like, yeah, all right. Okay, cool. So I went. They sent me Uptown Funk, which was almost going to be in the show. Bad Romance and Chandelier and some sides. So I was like, all right, cool. I think, you know, my wife's lack of faith, you know, weighing up. I was like, you know, I think I've got a good chance at this. So I'm going to drill it. I'm going to drill the sides, drill the music, and just, you know, put in that extra bit of hard work for it. So, you know, I went. And it was early in the morning, 10 o'clock. I was the first one in. And it was just Pippa Alien, who's the casting director in London, a piano player, and someone operating a video camera. And I was like, oh, all right. It's one of these then. Okay, cool. No team. Brilliant. So, I did my stuff. And she was like, I have thanked Pippa to this day, actually. I can't remember if I have, but I need to thank her, because she actually went, you know what? You can do it a bit bigger. Just be bigger. I was like, oh, all right, cool. So I think she saw it before I did. And I was like, all right, cool. So I did my things like a little bit bigger. And then she was like, yeah, that's great. That's good. I was like, yeah, cool. I kind of felt good. It didn't feel wrong to do it bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really go for it.
Yeah, because like you've seen you've obviously been in the show. You know what he's like. He's like, he's almost bordering on like psychotic, right? He's like big, right? Anyway, I went home, rang up my agent, old school, and I went, "Hey, dude, that went all right. Cool. I didn't make you look stupid. Don't worry, it's all good." And then like a week later, maybe 4 days later, he was like, "Dude." Dude, I was like, what? He's like, they've just availability checked you for the workshop day and the finals for Moulin Rouge. I was like, no way. He's like, yeah, they want to fly to New York. I was like, shit. No way, right? So I started freaking out. Nat was like, of course they're going to do that, aren't you? Of course they're going to fly you. I was like, yeah, yeah. I was like, all right, here we go again. Let's do it, right? So I had to sort out my little Esther travel visa thing, and then they flew me over, right, to New York the next week, I think it was. And there was a snowstorm, so it was a bit touch and go whether I was going to get there in time for the audition, so they flew me early. Anyway, I managed to get there, put me up a nice little hotel around the corner from Ripley Greer Studios.
Mm-hmm.
And
love it.
I went in the next day. And you know, I was like, I didn't know what to expect. I hadn't even been to that rehearsal space before. And I was looking around, you know, and I met someone from casting, and then that's where I met Katie Spellman and Fred. And it was my dance call first. And I did my dance call with Paloma Garcia Lee, who's of West Side Story fame.
Right.
And that was cool. It wasn't the tango that we know in the show, but it was a choreographed, passionate, throw on the floor kind of, you know, dance, was, you know, grabbing her hair, and, you know, it was a very passionate dance. So I did that, and then I met the music team. I met Justin Levine and Matt Stein, and they drilled me, man, on the music. They were super specific with what they wanted, with what I was just trying to marry what I had in my head and what was in Justin's head. Yeah. I didn't think Justin liked me because he was really drilling me. And I was like, all right, he's here to play. Let's go. I'm here to play too. Let's do it. Right.
Was it mostly Bad Romance, or what was he? Do you remember what he was like on you about?
It was Uptown Funk.
Okay.
Uptown Funk. Mm. Very specific with timing. Mm. Right.
Pocket.
Energy.
Yeah. Right.
You know, Bad Romance as well. It was a definite vibe of what he was wanting to get, which you can't get from a piano. That I rehearsed with or whatever. So this is the first bit of direction I'm taking for this audition. So usually you'd get a bit of direction earlier on if you're in an audition process, but this is like my final's tomorrow. So I thought, okay, cool. So, you know, he was talking it through me, what he wanted, what he heard in his head. It was very gypsy-like, you know. Dun, 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 dun. I want you to get... Dun, dun. Right. So mm-hmm. I was like, all right, that vibe, cool. Anyway, so we did that. It was great. And then I met Alex and Alex Timbers, director. We went through the sides, gave me direction. I can't remember what it was now, but it must have worked because I got the gig. So we did that, and it was a long day, you know. I was tired. I went back to the hotel, slept, and then I was back in at like 9:30 or 10 o'clock the next morning for the whole process. And, you know, my first time auditioning in New York for something like this, it was nice to see the difference. It's a lot more, it's almost like the stakes are higher in New York than in the West End. It's kind of a bit more relaxed in the West End, but in New York, it was a bit more, everyone's ready to play kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which is the way it should be. You know, everyone's there to work, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they put you in the little holding room, and that's when you start to suss people out.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, then, like, okay, he could be up.
And they're all looking at you like, who's this fucking guy? Where's he even from? I've never seen this guy in my life.
Who's this dude? He's got fucking suitcases, man. I was like,
oh. Right.
So my suitcases there. And they're like, so I met this guy, and he was like, hey, how you doing? I can't remember what his name is, but I've met him since. And, you know, we've had a chat about it. And he was like, oh, yeah, cool. And we get talking. He's like, I'm Ricky, you know. Oh, you're not from here. I was like, no, I'm from, you know, from overseas. Like, he's like, oh, yeah, I flew in from LA to audition for this. And I was like, oh, cool, cool. He's like, yeah, me too. He's like, where did you fly in from? They flew me over from London to audition for this gig. So, I'm here because they flew me. All right. And he was like, oh, okay, cool. So I was trying to play like some mind games and shit, right? I was like,
right, right.
Let's play some mind games, right? And then, right, I'm there waiting, and in through the door walks this Adonis, Hispanic, tanned Latino man dressed in black, right? And I was like, damn it. he comes in like speaking Spanish. He's like, aquí estamos para la audición de Moulin Rouge. And I was like, yeah, we're here for the audition, mate. And I was like, he's good looking. He's got a good chance. And I thought, and I thought to myself, no, he's not haggard enough. He's not old enough. He's not rough enough.
He's
right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's not living in Montmartre, like you know, living on red wine and cigarettes.
Yeah,
like,
he has. You know. He's not starving. Like
right,
like he's been fed.
Like, he's eating 3,000 calories of clean eating a day.
That's right.
This guy doesn't even smoke, right?
Right.
Anyway, so I was like, okay, cool. And then you know they call your name or they say they come and get you, whatever. So I did the dance call first, and it was with Sonia. First time I met Sonia Taya, the choreographer, and she was loving it. You know how vocal she is, Joe. She was like, yes, yes. Like,
just giving yelling. Right?
And I was like, yes, I'm getting it. And I'm like, yes. Right.
Right.
So that was fun. It was a fun dance call. And then I did the the scenes and the songs all in one hit with everyone in there with cameras and stuff, because they had to send all the video to Australia for the global team to see there. So I did it, and yeah, it went really super well. And Nick from casting was like, you know, couldn't have gone better. Have a safe flight. And then I got an Uber and went back to the, went and got my flight from JFK. Flew back. 2 days later, they were like, Hugo's like, you've just been offered the job, man. I was like, what? Oh. So that was amazing. And then all hell broke loose because I had to sort out the visa super fast. And I was doing a show in Australia. I was touring for a month with a like a Frankie Valli tribute out in Australia. And so we had to sort all that because, you know, Equity wanted to see all, you know, programs and all credits and everything else I'd done, and, you know, rightly so. And then I had to get like a visa appointment in Sydney, and but I was still in Perth with a show, and then I did my visa appointment, then my passport had to get sent to Melbourne where I was going to be with a show, and it was very touch and go, like the stars aligned, otherwise I wouldn't have made it. Then I went home, and 3 days later I was in New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's like lightning fast. And so fast. I mean, it's just, what a crazy, it's so like what's funny, I think, is like people, I imagine, think that that is what like the Broadway audition grind is like all the time. And it's like, that's not true. No. Like that is that what you were auditioning for, like the Broadway equivalent of a Marvel movie. You know, like you were it was as high stakes and as flashy and as, you know, sort of shiny as possible in a way, you know,
in almost all cases, they're like, so, yeah, you have a final callback for this thing. And you're like, yeah, cool. Well, I'm in San Diego. Oh, OK. So you're going to fly yourself out here. You're going to take 2 days off from your tour to come out here and fly yourself out here on your own dime. And you're going to sit in a studio for 12 hours. Then you're going to get in a hotel and do it, you know, fly back to your show. And hopefully you don't miss a show. And you sit in a studio for 12 hours and then somebody else gets the job anyway. It's usually how that goes. Not that I've had this experience at all, but it's only happened three times.
The thing is, I've had that experience but in London. Like, you know, same thing. You're on tour and you're like, oh, man, I'm in Sunderland. To get to London, that's like, what?
Right.
Like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you do it, and then you're like, oh, someone else has got the gig. I'm like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Right. I could have easily just taken a couple $100 and lit them on fire in front of, you know.
Yeah. And then you get to do this amazing show and bring it to New York, and you guys are selling a bunch of tickets, and you know, then COVID strikes, and now what's the plan? Do you have any ideas? Are you allowed to tell us?
Well, we haven't heard anything yet. You know, I'm hoping that there's a rumor thing that everyone's, you know, kind of Broadway's kicking back up like September time, October, like end of fall. So we're hoping it's going to be that. I mean, we've got to find out soon, though, for them to open up ticket sales and stuff like that. So I'm hoping we hear super soon. But the plan is to go back and, you know, and get to it again. I mean, we're going to get two opening nights. It's kind of this one's going to be more, it's going to be crazier than the first time we opened, I think.
Probably.
Because of,
yeah.
Without after everything we've all been through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think people are just aching for it, you know? So yeah, it's going to be, it's already, that show's already a rock concert. It's going to be, unbelievable. Well, I can't wait. I know that we all can't wait. You so far in your career so far, what would you say is the greatest challenge of your career so far? Maybe COVID aside.
Apart from a pandemic. I would say weathering the tough times, and you know, when you're not in a musical or when you don't have a gig, you know. It's the hustle is hard.
Yeah.
To find the gigs, you know, to make the work, to, you know, that's the hard bit, especially if you've got a family, you know.
Totally.
So what are some things you've done to make that work?
You know, do some work on cruise ships with a friend of mine's got a production company. He's got some great shows. He's doing super, super well. And he's got lots of shows that go out and do fly-ons to cruise ships as guest entertainers and fly-offs. So I do quite a lot of that. And it's mostly that, or any gigs that I can pick up here and there, you know, session singing work. I do quite a bit of.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cobbling it together. That's what, I mean, Dan and I talk about that all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been teaching a whole lot since like last September. So.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's, I mean, like for listeners, you know, Dan and I both teach, but I mean, honestly, Ricky, I want to take a lesson from you. I want a guitar lesson and I want a singing lesson and then I want a salsa lesson and I want
you to teach me how to look at women.
No,
listen, you do it like this.
You can't see what he's doing, but he's staring like Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
I was just going to say pretty much the best The Rock I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you smell what The Rock is cooking? Eyebrow lift is exactly what that looked like.
Do you smell what Santiago is cooking for you?
Is there a book or a resource or a person or a...
So my dad used to read loads of motivational books as I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always like, you know, telling me about all these things in these books and stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. It's like The Power of Positive Thinking and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So then he gave me a book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's like, they're all precursors to like Anthony Robbins and like The Secret and all that stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So I was like, and this book, it speaks sense. It's so old school and probably un-PC, you know, in politically incorrect in some bits and very sexist, but it's like you take from it and appreciate that it was written in a time, you know, way back in the 1940s or, you know.
Yeah.
But some, like the stuff he talks about still very relevant for now and for, you know, having a healthy, you know, mental state, I think, you know, and knowing things get better and to have faith and, you know, and keep plugging on, keep pushing on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. God, we all need to hear that.
Yeah.
Truly.
Oh my gosh. I love that. I love that.
So you grew up not very much a musical theater guy, but what would you call your most influential musical? Like, what was the point where you were like, okay, I dig this. I can do this now.
This is going to sound super weird, but it was Pirates of Penzance.
Love that.
So I did it at high school. And it was before I started at the ATYP, but it was like the first time I was like, I get this, you know, I get it. I played Frederick and I didn't play the pirate. I played the Pirate King many years later in London, in the pirate, you know, in Pirates, but then I was Frederick and I couldn't sing very high. So I don't think it sounded very good, but like, because Frederick's like a, you know, he's a proper tenor, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but I gave it my best and I loved it, you know.
Yeah.
It was super fun. Super good. But that's the musical or operetta.
Yeah. Dan, did you audition for that Pirates of Penzance at when they were trying to revive it? They were trying to bring it to New York.
No.
I think Will Swenson did it. And
I mean, I know they did it at the Muni one year when we were in school. They do it there all the time. But
this was probably 5 years ago, and it was like Algonquit or theater, the one in the Berkshires. Anyway, I auditioned for Friedrich, and it was one of the worst auditions that I have ever had because also, like, I'm like a baritone who likes to pretend he's a tenor, and so went in and sang that song, and it just did not. It did not work.
Oh, is there not one maiden breast?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Yep. It was not great. But I want to know. I want them to, like, I want a full-fledged revival of that. I want like a really big, you know, huge orchestra. Like, give me,
you know, what's cool? The one I did, was the all male production by Sasha Reagan. And I did it at Wilton Halls in London, which is the oldest music hall in the world, I think. And it was like all the female parts were played by men, countertenors. And it was, to this day, well, up until Moulin Rouge, it was my dad's favorite thing I've ever done.
Oh,
and
cool.
It was absolutely nuts. He was like, mate, bloody beautiful, mate. This production, mate, the boys, mate, the boys' voice, he sings so high, mate. Bloody beautiful, mate. Perfect. I love it, mate. I love it. I was like, thanks, Dad.
Anything about my performance? No. Okay, cool, Dad. Anything thanks, Dad. Yeah.
You know, I didn't get paid much doing this, but it's fine. You know, like it's bigger budget stuff. No? Okay, cool. Thanks, Dad.
Oh, my God. I love that. And then I ask this question of all of our guests when we get towards the end. I call it the unreachable star question, which is kind of the, you know, what are you pointed towards on the horizon, like a million years from now? Things, something you want to accomplish, something you want to do.
Oh man, I want to do like a film. I just want to do a film, a good film.
Yeah.
You know, that's not Hollywood-y. That's not, you know, I want a good character, something that I can get my teeth into, something that, to play it, to surrender to it would scare me. Like, I want that. Mm. Yeah. You know what I mean? Where you're like on the edge of like, if I get too far to it, it scares you if you do it properly, you know?
100%.
That's what I want.
I love that. That's what I want. I love that. Something super, super artsy. This up in your face. And I think there's a fear about camera in general. I think for people who grew up and love the stage, that like that intimacy of having that thing just right in your face.
Of course.
Having you go through something, you know.
It's like very talking intimate. It's like doing a scene, but someone's like right in front of your face. It's you know. Yeah. I think just be real. I think if you're real and you believe it, I think that's the first hurdle. You just have to be real.
I
love
it's actually happening, right? Yeah. Like getting lost, like the fear of getting lost in the thing being so part of you that you're lost in that moment, and you're like, wait, am I me, or am I this character? Is this actually happening? That's what I want.
That's what I want so bad.
Yeah, and I've had that experience like 3 times.
Yeah,
like individual scenes, like individual moments, you know, and then you're always trying to chase that thing again.
Exactly. It's such a buzz, man.
Yeah.
It's such a buzz.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I want that. I want that for you. I want to see it.
Yeah.
I want it for everyone, for all of us.
Yeah. For sure.
Where can people see or hear from you, Ricky? Where are you in the world?
Well, you know, Instagram. I'm going to start putting, I used to do like Thursday lives when I was in the show, where I used to, I like warming up. I warm up with my guitar. I sing for, you know, a good solid 45 minutes, an hour before the show. I thought one day, you know, I'm just going to put it on a live every Thursday and just leave the phone there and see what happens. And, you know, people ended up liking it. And then, you know, everyone would come to my dressing room and say hi. And Aaron Tveit would come in and sing a couple of songs.
Wait, move aside. Let me sing.
I was like, dude, it's my life.
No, listen, man, this is my time, okay? You're the star of this show. No, we love Aaron on this show. He's a good guy. Just teasing him.
Step aside.
The thing to do is tease him. He's so pretty.
Handsome guys that are that talented and successful, you just have to bring them down. That's why I'm so mean to Joe. I'm surprised I didn't do it on this episode.
Well, here you are. We're 45 minutes in, and you got your first shot in of the episode, my friend. Oh my gosh. What are you playing right now, guitar-wise? Are you working on any music? You playing anything?
You know what? I haven't written anything. I just like to play. I'm playing my nice guitar. I've got a couple of nice guitars at the moment because they never travel with me. I've got my Guild, D40, which is from 1963. It's very old. You'll appreciate this.
Yes.
It's super old.
Mm.
Wow.
Yummy.
Wow.
I've got a Gibson 1968 Blue Ridge, which I fixed up because I fixed guitars as well. I did that many years ago, and yeah, just play those.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like, just to recap, it sounds like, so you're a luthier, you're refurbishing your house.
Yeah.
You've moved to France, you know, like this is, I think that, you know, the pandemic, you're certainly being more productive than I am. you've shaved and regrown mustaches. I love it. This is catching up with Ricky Rojas.
You know, listen, measure twice, cut once. That's the motto for fixing up things, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and then what's the worst that can happen? You just replace it.
That's right.
Unless it's a really antique, like vintage guitar, which you have to be careful with. But hey, most of the time it's not vintage and it's not antique. Right. So it's all good.
Right.
I just love it. I love it. Oh, Ricky. Well, I miss you desperately, and we'll sit at Beer Culture on 45th or whatever, you know, but, you know, there's like a light at the end of a tunnel that we're just entering.
That's right. I can see it. I can see it. And then we'll be back in my dressing room, having a whiskey, playing guitar.
Ugh, I miss it so much. My friend, thank you. Stay well.
Thank you, Ricky.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Guys Who Like Musicals. We are now part of the Broadway Podcast Network.
Woo!
We are hosted by Dan Tracy.
That's you.
And Joe Carroll.
That's me.
We're produced by Ryan Kincaid, and Matthew Mucha is the social content manager.
You can find us on Instagram at Guys Who Like Musicals, on Twitter at Musical Guys, or the old-fashioned way at www.guyswholikemusicals.com.
If you'd like a chance to be featured on the Ask the Guys segment of our show, please call 203-900-7990 and leave a message with your question. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.